Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show.
Good day. I'm Christine Lear. I am a fellow with the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, and I'm joined today with the usual suspects, Dr. Carl Rose and Natalie Treloa. Welcome to the show, and today I'm delighted to have with us Dr. Peter Layton. He is a visiting fellow at the Griffith Asia Institute at Griffith University, a Royal United Services Institute in the UK Associate Fellow, and a fellow at the Australian Security Leaders Climate Group. He has extensive aviation and defence experience, including flying fast jets and maritime patrol, force development, major equipment projects, and as a defence attaché. For his work at the Pentagon on force structure matters, he was awarded the US Secretary of Defense's Exceptional Public Service Medal. Dr. Layton has a doctorate from the University of New South Wales on grand strategy. He contributes regularly to the public policy debate on defense and foreign affairs issues and is the author of the book Grand Strategy and co-author of Warfare in the Robotic Age. And so we're delighted to have Peter with us today, because we're going to unpack a little bit more, as Dr. Carl explored previously in the recently released National Defence Strategy, the Australian National Defence Strategy. Some of the concepts that Australia has not really had to think about for quite some time. And so, Peter, we're really keen to get your thoughts on some of the issues presented, some of the concepts presented in that paper, such as deterrence within an alliance. So, Peter, I know you have some thoughts, and please just jump in.
So this year was an important year for Australian defence in that Australia got a new national defence strategy. In fact, the first national defence strategy for Australia ever. And the national defence strategy made Australia's primary strategic defence objective conventional deterrence. And that meant that anything defence does must contribute clearly to supporting deterrence. Now, the National Defence Strategy made clear also that there's two defence there's two objectives within that overall objective. The first involves working with the US and key partners to ensure no country attempts to achieve its regional objectives through military action. This involves Australia making a credible contribution to a favourable regional strategic balance. That's fine. However, in a potentially significant shift, a major political party in the US, and by implication many Americans, are no longer attracted to America's alliance network. Now, this network was created for collective defence, for countries to stand together against a common foe. For 100 years, democracies like Australia put great store on collective defence. It's a major cornerstone of democratic nations' grand strategies. So if we go back to Australia's first deterrence objective, if the US leaves the region, as the United Kingdom did back in 1968, would Australia's contribution to deterrence be sufficient to help create and maintain a favourable regional strategic balance? That's all good balance of power, realism stuff, if you like. Can we and our partners make a favourable regional strategic balance by ourselves?
Yeah, really, really good points there. So, yeah. I mean, my question would be, and this is a question, you know, for the future, looking forward, you know, is Australia building force to contribute to an alliance or to carry its own water in deterrence? And, you know, how might that focus force in case one, you know, look different than the focus force in case two, where you're working in an alliance versus where you're trying to deter and protect your own interests outside of the alliance should, you know, the partner not show up? It's a really important question, right?
So that gets back to the view of, should we even try to work with, say, Japan or the Philippines or Thailand or India or somebody else like that and make a regional balance? Or if the US leaves, should Australia just declare your regional strategic balance an impossible dream?
Yeah, it's a great question, Peter. And I think it speaks to a broader question about Australia's strategic culture, because Australia is quite an anomaly in international history in terms of at least, you know, modern, what we might term modern Australia. In terms of, you know, we've always had a Western maritime power. I don't want to use the word dominate, but sort of like manage the region for us. But I'm interested as well because you brought up a great question previously about, you know, the how we think about offense versus defense in the modern era and how technology contributes to shaping perceptions of what is the best sort of posture to adopt. I'm curious in your thoughts about that. Like how, well, one, in alliance, and two, if we were to deter independently.
I mean, this gets back to being perhaps a related question or a point there. At the moment, a lot of strategic commentators are thinking that when we start thinking about conventional deterrence, that the world's moving towards, in that offense-defense balance, towards having an emphasis upon defense. So that the technology which is emerging, and everyone talks about drones now and AI and connectivity and various things like that, that the Ukraine shows us to a certain degree that the defense might be stronger than the offense. If the defense is stronger, that means status quo powers, such as Australia, but also the US and the rest of the Southeast Asia, that maybe maybe we could stand by ourselves if we have to, because defence now is in fact stronger. I was very struck by Luke Gosling, who wrote an AUKUS report for Lowy, and he had a throwaway line. It was just a throwaway line. He said, for the cost of 8 definitely offensive nuclear submarines, attack boats, Australia could buy 1,000 more F-35 fighter jets. Now, I'm not saying we should buy 1,000 F-35 fighter jets, but it does give a hint or hint somewhat at that, if you like, purely at the cost-benefit sort of equation there between offence and defence. You may be able to have a very big defence versus a small offence. So, and again, it's one of those judgment calls. Is the world going towards defence or offence? And can you make a sharp distinction between defense and offense?
That's a great question conceptually. Carl, you've worked on these issues when you were at RAND. Thoughts?
Yeah, so here's my thoughts on it is, you know, when people think offense in the traditional United States role, they're usually thinking about projecting power, deploying forces, either, you know, having them stationed forward or deploying them forward in the event of a crisis. That takes time and resources in and of itself. So it's always easier to work in your own near region than at a distance. This has always been one of the challenges. You know the region better if it's your own territory, for example, or if it's your own, you know, close coastal waters as compared to going to a far region, and it's also easier to keep the forces there and to have them prepared. So, you know, I think, look, the defense has always had the advantage, but with the advent of more sensors, you know, less surprise these days, I think the defense has gotten a bigger edge. It's harder to hide forces. It's harder to hide movements. It's harder to hide actions in today's world with so many sensors shining down everywhere. So that may make the defense a lot easier. And I think that's one of the challenges that we've seen in, you know, the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And Dave Johnson was one of the first to point this out, which is with ubiquitous sensors, it is impossible to gain surprise and mass forces on the battlefield without being hit. So how do you work through that conundrum if you really want to undertake offensive operations? And if you're a defender, you have great advantages, I think. So those are my takes on it.
Those are some great points, Carl. And you've got me thinking because it immediately brought me back to one of my favorite movies that I watch maybe sometimes when I'm tipsy. 13 Days. The concept of surprise and disguise, how the Soviets were amassing missiles in Cuba and like it... The U.S. found out after a certain amount of time, but like it's really interesting, this concept of time and surprise and how, you know, how that evolves with the evolution of technology as well. It's really interesting. Peter, another topic that we're curious to know your thoughts about, which is, you know, I one that is personally I don't really care too much for, but, you know, it's the buzzword of the day. Integrated deterrence. You know, a lot of Australians are jumping on this concept because it's really popular and, oh, yes, I know all about integrated deterrence. It's like, well, yeah, okay. But I know you have some particular thoughts on it. Please, I'd love to hear.
So, yeah, once we so as we've been talking about, I suppose, is the issue of having to think about Australia deterring others just by itself, if Australia has to do something by itself. And that's one problem. But the other problem is, you know, one of Australia's pressing deterrence problems is China's grey zone actions. And so China's becoming more assertive. And over the last couple of years, China has been instigating a number of incidents which could have possibly led to Australian Defence Force personnel being injured or an extremist killed. So we'd like to be able to deter China from continuing with those grey zone actions against Australian forces, as well as being able to stand by ourselves, let's say. So integrated deterrence might be another option there, whereby we can use something else apart from military force or in conjunction with military force, something like diplomacy or information or economics. And the diplomacy side is the classic stuff. You know, Australia could send some diplomats home. I mean, even here in Brisbane, we've got 14 or 15 Chinese nationals at the consulate here. What are they doing? We could perhaps send those home as to sort of deter people as part of our integrated deterrence. There's lots of different economic sanctions and actions against Chinese state-owned enterprises. There's lots of information stuff as well. But, of course, to deter using integrated deterrence, you also need to make sure that the other side understands what will happen if they do certain things. So if we went along the line of integrated deterrence, we need to signal about that and message about that very carefully.
Yeah, and look, I'm going to throw a bomb in the room. There's this great, for our Australian audience, but also an American audience, there's this quote-unquote great TV show called Utopia, and there's a specific Department of Defense episode where you've got a bunch of people in the room and sort of, you know, one of the government people saying, oh, you know, we're spending $400 billion dollars in the forward estimates, you know, what are we deterring, you know, and the military is sort of saying, well, and the civilians, let's be honest, are saying, oh, you know, we're deterring an Asia-Pacific power. And the guy's like, oh, can you be more specific, you know, $400 billion, pick one. It's like, oh, an Indo-Asia-Pacific power. It's like, well, it's quite funny. But it goes to the question of, like, what are we deterring? Who are we deterring? Against what? Like, it's still not clear what we're actually doing. So, I mean, I have my own thoughts, obviously, but Carla, throw it to you. What are your perceptions? What are your impressions of Australian deterrence signalling, and is it adequate? And like, are we gonna say what we're deterring?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is an open question as to what specifically we are deterring. And look, that Utopia episode, and I think in the U.S. it's called Dreamland on Netflix. It has a different title in the U.S., but you can find it on Netflix. But it points to a major challenge for Australia, which is Australia's, if we were to write a national security strategy, and that's not what this episode's about, because too many people said, oh, we need to write a national security strategy in Australia. But if we were to write one, someone would need to square the circle around the economy is very driven by exports. And a lot of those exports go to China, the raw materials that go to China. And our defense is focused on how do we deter China from doing bad things in the region and increasing influence. So someone would need to square that circle as part of the national security strategy if one was ever written. So it is a real challenge. And to deter, you're very right, Peter, that we have to be clear about what we want to deter and what red lines exist and what actions will be taken. And this is the really hard part, in my opinion, about the gray zone is, okay, so a bunch of chaff was dropped in front of a, you know, surveillance aircraft, an Australian surveillance aircraft by a Chinese fighter. That's a bad thing. It could have led to the aircraft going down potentially, or damage to the aircraft, or injuring people on board. What is the proper response to that? Is it kicking out diplomats, as you mentioned? Is it withdrawing, trade in certain areas, or marking up the price of iron ore, putting tariffs on exports? What is the right action to that is the really tricky part of the gray zone, because the right action to, China coming and trying to invade Australia is you fight back, right? That's very clear. But what is the right response to a gray zone? That is the real question. I don't know if there are any good answers there.
And of course, the crazy thing is we can see this getting worse each year. So it's like there's like a trend line out there. But as you imply there, we need to have a think about this beforehand, so that this doesn't suddenly surprise us, if you like. So that rather than the government being driven by sort of public opinion, if you like, because public opinion would be fairly unfavourable towards the adversary of the grey zone. What should Australia do?
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen a lot. Some commentators say, the prime minister should pick up the phone and call Xi Jinping. And I'm like, I don't know if he'd even answer, number one, nor do I know if he would really do anything about that. Calling on the phone and giving harshly worded statements about we don't like this is probably not good enough to deter, right?
Well, I mean, China's Global Times, which is virtually a media outlet, which is used and part of the Chinese Communist Party, provides advice to us all the time about we should withdraw from Southeast Asia and withdraw from East Asia. So we do get lots of advice from China now about what we should do, if you like, in a grey zone sense. But you're right, a harsh telephone call is hardly likely to placate the Australian people or deter anyone.
Yeah, exactly. And the one thing where I think China actually went too far was, if you look back to 2021, 2022, where Australia was calling for an investigation into COVID in various the United Nations and, international health organizations into, what's the source of COVID. This obviously made China upset, and they put in place a number of economic coercion tactics, I'll call it that, sanctions or, not buying coal, those kinds of things. And I think they actually went too far, because many around the world saw this as a harsh action. Australia took a resilience piece of that, which is we're going to find other ways to sell these goods, and made out okay, and China ended up looking like the bad guy. So look, I don't know if that's a case study as to how to deal with it, how to be more resilient. But when it comes to China threatening ADF members who are out doing their job, that's probably a step too far, and we need to come up with better ideas for that.
I mean, that example, of course, shows that integrated deterrence may not work all that well. While the Americans sort of call it a team sport, and they'd like the Allies to be inside with them. In that case of China sanctioning Australia and refusing to take Australian exports of, say, coal, American companies stepped into the breach and provided China with coal rather than us, America and Canada. So it's the old story that in trade you have no friends and no allies, only permanent interests. But Australia does integrate a deterrence now, in a way, because we impose a whole range of cross-domain sanctions against Iran and North Korea. So to a point, we are using the technique as we speak.
Peter, how well do you think that conventional deterrence will go against China's changing nuclear doctrine? Like, for example, we've seen when Japan questioned the rallies in Hong Kong in the protests in Hong Kong in December 2020. We then saw China threaten a non-nuclear weapon state with nuclear attack. How do you see Australia sort of faring under those conditions as well, and what would that look like in terms of that integrated deterrence and conventional deterrence piece as well? And do you think Chinese doctrine is changing?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a debate about whether Chinese doctrine is changing or whether just the Chinese are trying to keep up with the Americans, if you like, and are doing it for matters of prestige and to give them more strategic or autonomy. But I don't think Australia would fare very well at all, because certainly in the last century, people were convinced that conventional deterrence didn't work very well by itself, that you needed the backup of nuclear weapons. That I suppose gets us to the second part of Australia's strategic defence objectives, which was to deter countries using force to coerce Australia. And that's much more precise. And I suppose we could use some form of integrated deterrence on something which is easy to define, if you like, that using force against Australia is obvious and tangible and if you like, physical. So it might be appropriate in a situation like that. But in that third party case about Hong Kong, I just can't see it working at all.
Yeah. And when it comes to nuclear, I mean, this is where just news just came out about the United States and South Korea more kind of formalizing a relationship on how to think about nuclear deterrence. And South Korea clearly has a pressing problem with nuclear deterrence, given the North is right there. But how does that integration and how will it work in the future when we think about extended nuclear deterrence? Because Australia is really counting on the United States in that area. If China was to threaten nuclear action or against Australia, there's not much response Australia has to step up to that, you know, kind of same level on the escalation ladder in terms of threats. So how does the United States and Australia think about working together better on extended deterrence and, you know, making that clear, right?
I mean, I think depending how things go in the US, the big question for next year will be America reassuring the allies, because extended deterrence obviously relies upon the non-nuclear powers having a confidence that the US will be providing this in extremis. But it's still an open question. And as far as making nuclear threats go, of course, the genie's out of the bottle now. President Putin makes nuclear threats against Europe and other people all the time. So one would assume that China will take a leaf out of that book at some stage and start making nuclear threats as well. So the nuclear threat business looks like having been reestablished in our current international order.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I love your terminology, Peter. You know, the nuclear threat business. I think it's really interesting how we have thought about the Cold War, and now that nuclear threats are coming back as a thing, I think it's easy to forget that, you know, nuclear weapons, they're kind of here to stay. Despite the hope of the 90s that we might have been able to get rid of them, they are, I think, and I'm sure many people agree with me, they are a permanent feature of the international system, whether we like it or not. We might as well get smarter about thinking about how to not use them, but how they are an instrument for geopolitical order. Nuclear threats will not go away, and this is something Australia is having to learn about in a much more direct fashion, perhaps, I think, because Australia has traditionally not been at the forefront, at least since the end of the Second World War, has not been at the forefront of geopolitical sort of competition, and now it's kind of learning to exist in that space between the US and China. And I think this is a really interesting time for Australia, because it's not necessarily nuclear learning as such, which is a concept that has been bandied around, especially between, you know, sort of India and Pakistan. All countries go through phases of nuclear learning, learning each other's behaviours and what is signalling and what does a signal mean or not? Is it an escalation and so forth? Like, you know, sort of like not DEFCON style, but like kind of in that vein. I think Australia is about to embark on a really interesting journey of understanding how to exist in a region where there is, which is at the forefront of geopolitical tension. So I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up. Peter, thank you so much. We've been delighted to have you. And it's great to have another Australian voice on deterrence. There are scholars out there. We just, you know, we just have to find them and give them a voice. And we've been delighted to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And we'd be keen to have you again, obviously. Team, any final thoughts before I give the final words?
I mean, we brought up a few topics here that we're going to have to wind back to in future episodes. This whole question of integrated deterrence and how nuclear plays in that, the whole question of deterring in the gray zone, what actions, all fodder for the future, and love to have you back on, Peter.
Thanks, Carl.
Yeah, and I'd also love to look at the, you know, even if we did have 1,000 F-35s and we did threaten to take out a Chinese base in the Solomon Islands, where we've seen sort of Kirk Campbell try to not really discuss those red lines or draw those red lines in 2022, and you know, would China come back with a nuclear threat even if we had the ability to threaten something like that?
Well, thank you, team. Hey, the listeners, I wanted to flag that the STRATCOM Deterrence Symposium is coming up next month, and Deterrence Down Under, we're going to be there. So if you want to come and say hi, we've got some free pins going out, and we'd love to meet you. So yeah, don't be a stranger. We'll be there. And if nothing else, just look out for my loud laugh. thank you, team. And so we'll leave it there, but stand by for more exciting episodes of Deterrence Down Under.
And don't forget to always think deterrence. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.